Welcome to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, resources, tools, practices, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode is my good friend and leading environmental toxin educator, Lara Adler. Through her practitioner training programs, Lara has coached and educated thousands of health professionals and individuals with health-based businesses from over 30 countries to better understand the role of environmental chemical exposures in causing or contributing to chronic illness and chronic health conditions, so they can pass this knowledge along to their own clients and patients. In this episode, you will learn how Lara became the self-professed environmental toxins nerd and leading educator in the field, why she strongly insists on accuracy in citing data when discussing environmental toxins, where people often go wrong when starting out the process of making healthier choices for their home and personal care products, why this is a political issue and the number one most powerful thing people can do to make change, and then several free and easy steps you can take today to reduce the toxic burden on your own body and that of your family. And if you find this topic interesting, head over to rebelhealth.co/cleanliving to grab the Clean Living Guide ebook, which shares a ton of our best tips and product recommendations to make less toxic choices for your home and family. And now, let's get things underway. Lara, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's going to be fun. You're one of my favorite people to talk to in this industry, and so I'm excited
Likewise.
To have you on. I'm excited to have you on one of the first episodes of the new show, and it's a topic that tons of people are interested in, and I think there's a lot we can kind of clear up and maybe help people be a little less freaked out.
Yes, I like this noble goal.
As they've already heard, we're going to be talking today about toxins and environmental toxins and toxicity. And that's something that, you know, was kind of, I don't want to say on the fringe, but when I started in this world of health stuff about 12, 13 years ago now, toxins weren't near the top of the list of the things that people were talking about a lot. It was more about diet or exercise or things along those lines. But now, it is definitely something people are talking about a lot.
Yes.
And I think practitioners are a lot more informed, which I think you had something to do with, so kudos. And but it can almost go too far, I think, which we're going to kind of talk about. So
Yeah. Before
we get into those things, I'd like you to share a little bit about, and I've interviewed you a bunch of times, and I don't think we've ever talked about this, how Lara's Instagram handle is Environmental Toxins Nerd. And I'm curious, you probably didn't grow up being like, when I grow up, I want to be the environmental toxins nerd.
No.
So how did that actually come about? How did you get interested in the topic? How did you create a business around educating practitioners about toxins?
Yeah. So for a long time, I used to tell this story like it was an accident that I just kind of stumbled into it. And then a couple years ago, I kind of had this moment that I'll share that I was like, huh, maybe not so much of an accident. So like, I think a lot of people who are in the wellness space, in the health space, medical profession, whatever, they kind of come to their area where they're focusing because they have their own health challenge that they, you know, overcame, or they saw somebody in their family have to contend with, and that kind of motivated them to do work in that space. I didn't have that. I didn't have any toxic exposure. I didn't know anything about toxic exposures. But I was a nerd, still am a nerd, and was somebody who was really interested in nutrition and wellness from a really early age. So, you know, when I was in high school, actually it was middle school, I was interested in being vegetarian. I became vegetarian, then vegan. I'm neither of those things anymore. But at the time I was like had this voracious appetite for learning all about food and nutrition and how to eat well. Because my family didn't know anything about being vegan, and they were like, well, that's probably unhealthy. And I was like, haha, let me read all about it so that I'm not being an unhealthy vegan. And so that was really how I kind of dipped my toe in that, in this sort of health space. But that was just something that was, I just did that personally. Professionally, I was kind of on this other path. And so long story short, after, you know, about 8 years in another profession post-college, I still was the nerd who was like going to fermentation workshops and learning how to grow mushrooms and, you know, make my own food and taking cooking classes in New York City, where I was living at the time. And I had all these people suggest, like, why don't you go to like do something with food and nutrition? And finally, I was like, you know what? Okay, fine. So I decided to pursue work in health coaching because I thought this was an opportunity for me to kind of flex this nutrition and wellness muscle that I'd kind of developed in my own life. And so I went back to school, got certified as a health coach, started working with clients in New York City, where I was living at the time. I didn't know anything about business, really. I didn't really know that much about how I didn't have that many tools to help people. I had some. I had the nutrition and lifestyle stuff that I had learned. And so I was working with people primarily around weight loss. That's what they were mostly coming to me for. Most of my clients that I was working with, they, you know, did all the things. They changed their diet. They slept better. They exercised more. They lost weight. They were happy. And then I had like two or three clients that were also doing all those things, but nothing was changing for them. And I was, you know, a year, 2 years into doing this work. So clearly I was like, well, there's obviously something I'm missing. And I felt very obligated to try to figure that out. So I started digging into the literature around resistant weight loss. And that's sort of the first awareness that I had about toxic chemicals. That's where I learned about toxic chemicals, chemicals in our environment that were linked to changes in metabolism that could lead to resistant weight loss, weight gain, changing metabolic set points, storing calories as fat, all this stuff. And these were chemicals that are just in our daily environment. And that really was kind of, you know, as they say, a blow your hair back kind of moment. I was like, whoa, 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 what is this? I have spent the last 10, 12 years, like, consuming everything that I knew to consume on this topic. And this was never really brought up. Even in the nutrition program that I did, the extent of the conversation around toxics was really pesticides are bad and processed food like margarine is bad. That was like the extent of it. And so when I learned about this, I just, like, my first emotional reaction was outrage. I was just like, can I swear?
Sure.
I was just like, what the fuck is this? Like, are you?
I was there too when I first started learning about the toxic stuff in the books I was reading. I was just like, what? Like, what? How? And then you learn, you know, why it's allowed and how it's allowed. And it's not like a secret. Like, you don't know what those chemicals do, but they know what they do.
Yeah.
Like, people know. People know. And they sell them and use them and use them a lot. Like, the amounts are staggering. Yeah. Anyways, it's enraging.
And so, like, I remember one of the first things, and this is sort of my benchmark for how long I've been doing this. So my sister-in-law was pregnant with my niece at the time, and I was researching crib mattresses. And the toxic chemicals that are found were used in the manufacture of crib mattresses. And that was really what pissed me off. My niece is now 15 years old. So she is, however old she is really when, like, how long I've been kind of immersed in this conversation. And so I just remember being pissed off. And I was like, why is nobody talking about this? The literature is there. The data is there for some of this stuff, but it wasn't being passed down to at least the circles that I was navigating at the time, which was health coaches, nutritionists, some dietitians, some naturopathic doctors. That was really it. And again, this was 15 years ago.
And it would hit there before it would hit the general consumers.
Yes.
So it was nowhere near the general consumer
Not lexicon. Not really. I mean, in some pockets, yes. Like, you know, but broadly speaking, no. This was not the conversation has changed and amplified so much in the last 15 years. And it's been really validating to see that. Because in the beginning, I felt very much in the wellness space, at least, like an outlier. Like, nobody else is talking about this. And I'm like, am I going to get, you know, lampooned for bringing these topics up? But I'm such a data-driven person that everything that I was sharing was rooted in scientific literature. And so I felt more and more confident to start sharing this information. And then that little twist that I mentioned earlier, that I kind of had this like, oh, wait a second. So two things. One, this was about 7 years ago. I went back to my childhood home. My dad was having his 80th birthday. We all went back home. And I don't know if you have this experience, if you ever go back to like your old childhood bedroom to see like the stuff that you left behind that you never took with you as you moved on to adulthood, but that your family still kept. So there was just like some random items in the room. And I found a box of index cards from when I was in high school. This was 1992, from a paper report that I was writing on vegetarian diets at the time, because that was what I was into. And it was an index card, a box of index cards, because that's in the 90s how we wrote, we cited sources, oh, yeah, in our bibliography, right? And I pulled out, there's probably about 50 references in here, index cards. I pulled one out at random. I have this photo somewhere on my Instagram. I posted it a couple times. And it is a quote from some book saying something to the effect of, more and more people are turning to a vegetarian diet in part because of toxic chemicals used in blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of like, huh, well, that's weird. The second part of this story is that my father, for the last 20 something years, has actually worked in the nonstick coating industry. And so I have been acutely aware of PFAS coatings. I've gone to trade shows. In the 90s when I was, late 90s when I was still in college, I was forwarding news articles about Teflon toxicosis, which is the name given to the condition that birds who are in homes where non-stick pans are being heated, that release fumes, and those fumes can be fatal to birds. That's referred to as Teflon toxicosis. And so I was forwarding articles to my dad in probably 1999, 2000, so 24 years ago, about this. And he was forwarding them to the president of the company, saying like, hey, this is a thing. So like, I kind of laugh now and I'm like, oh, I've been a thorn in the side of this industry, however small, for like 24 years, at least.
Well, that's good. They need more thorns in their side.
I know. It was just sort of this so, like, oh, I guess I have in a way been doing this for a lot longer.
Since before you thought you were, or before you knew exactly you were. And I want to go back to, thanks for sharing all that. And I want to go back to, you were working with health clients and stubborn weight loss. And somebody that you introduced me to actually gave a presentation about that topic for our toxicity and detox masterclass at Rebel Health, Dr. Vivian Chen, or you recommended I talk to her. I don't remember if you actually introduced us, but I know of her because of you.
Yeah.
And she gave a presentation on obesogens and chemicals that like stunt metabolism and change the way that we process calories and food, and that it actually can, like, two people consuming the same amount of calories can gain or lose different amounts of weight due to chemical exposures. And that flips like the whole, what is that, law of thermodynamics, just eat less, on its head. Because I also had clients when I was working with clients 10 years ago who were doing everything right and exercising and eating well and whatever. And some of them would lose a bunch of weight and some of them it was like
nothing.
Very, very difficult. And luckily, I stumbled across a lot of this stuff when I first started with health clients. Like the way I got grad school, no, I have a master's in exercise physiology. Didn't mention any of this one time, not a single mention of it, zero times. Whole master's program, nothing. Then I read an article by Paul Check, the founder of the Check Institute, about Burger King milkshakes. And he listed the like 40 something ingredients in a Burger King milkshake and was like, went on this huge rant of, you want to know why we're sick and overweight and this and this and this and this? What the hell is this? And what is this? And what is this? And what is this? And he broke down all of these complete, like a milkshake should have like three ingredients in it. And he broke down all these chemicals and preservatives and flavorings and da 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 and all this stuff, and then listed studies around each one and what it does. And that caught my attention enough that I started studying at his institute and going down the more like functional medicine-y route. So it was actually toxins that drew me into that world a little bit, because it made sense. It was like, well, what is all that crap and why do we eat it and what does it do to us? And that's not actually food. And food chemicals are just one.
Yes.
One little beep, there's this. But that's what got me kind of interested in this. And then I read a few books on like water toxic, whatever, what the movie Dark Water.
Dark Waters, with Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah, whatever the book version, or I read about that in a book a while back, and it was like, all of these people need to be in prison. Like, why is all this going on? So we're not going to get into the depths of environmental toxicity. We have a whole course with you. We have a bunch of things on our platform where we teach like environmental toxicity. I want to talk more about if somebody's just kind of getting into that topic, or they're already into it, they're already in the health world, they're already trying to make their lives cleaner, and have less exposure to these chemicals for themselves and their kids. You mentioned cribs, and like learning about stuff that they put in things that are for kids is the most infuriating of all the things. So I like to ask people what kind of either mistakes are being made when people are trying to approach their area of expertise, or myths or misconceptions. And so what would you say people might be really well-intentioned, but are kind of going about this in a way that's not super healthy?
Yeah. So I'll start by saying this, like, I'm not the toxins police here, you know, in terms of like policing how people communicate about this issue, but I'm a hyper observant person. And I am somebody who spends time reading comments sections of other people's content, of news articles. And I did that before social media existed. I was reading the comment sections on articles about this because I wanted to see how information is being received by the average person. And I feel like there's so much value in paying attention to that. And so what I see as, from my experience, the mistakes that people make are generally communication mistakes, right? It's poor science communication. And that can show up in a couple of different forms. And again, the intention might be very good. Oftentimes, the intention is someone's trying to sell you something. So like, we have to also consider that. They're selling a product or a detox product or a supplement or something like that, which like they have a, those things have a place, a time and a place, but they're not, that should be a flag to look for. I'm not even going to call it a red flag, just a flag to identify. I think the biggest problem is people, number one, sensationalizing this topic. They're overstating the science, they're overhyping, they're making statements that are not actually supported by the research. I see this literally every single day. I even said to you before we started recording, I literally was just watching somebody spout about how you should never, ever, 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 emphasis, ever, ever drink tap water because it is so toxic. Now, I've been teaching about water contamination for over a decade now, and I highly encourage people to filter their water, but I stopped making statements, absolute statements like never and always years ago, because I realized that those absolute statements are very exclusionary to a lot of people who don't have access, who don't have the funds to go out and spend hundreds of dollars on a water tester or a water filter. And that we don't live in absolute terms. We live in this very dynamic, gray, fluid existence where like, hey, you know what? Sometimes I drink tap water, and shock horror, sometimes I will even drink bottled water, even though I know that it has contaminants, that it may have microplastics, because like, hey, I'm at an airport and I forgot my water bottle at home. I also don't want to be dehydrated, right? So anyway, going back to the sensationalist pattern that I see people expressing information about toxicity is it gets clicks. It's like the outrage farming on social media, right? Like, we know that people are like, oh my God, this is terrible. And that gets likes and it gets comments, and that's the currency of social media. But that conversation, to anybody who is scientifically literate or who has an inkling of a idea of the reality of this situation, it comes off as childish. It comes off as just a really inappropriate way to communicate about this topic, which makes it easier for people to dismiss it as being just something that crazy people say. And the conspiracy theory angle is a whole other one. But like, that's the thing that like really frustrates me, because we absolutely need more people talking about environmental health issues, environmental toxicity, disproportionate exposure, environmental justice issues. We desperately need more voices. And those voices should ideally be balanced and evidence-based and not sensationalized. And that's like the biggest mistake that I see people making. It really hurts the entire conversation for everyone who's in it, including the research scientists who've dedicated their careers to doing this work.
I totally agree. And I think that there's enough that's rooted in really solid data and research that you can share that is shocking.
You don't need to hype it up.
That you don't need to hype it up. Like, there's so much, like, the rabbit hole of this is endless, and the depth to which it goes, and the depravity, and the like insidious, like, the, if you want to find that stuff and want it to be 100% accurate, you will find it and share it, and you don't have to hype it up. Like, you don't, there's enough. There's enough that's rooted in fact, that's completely like, it's just unnecessary. Not only is it harmful, it's unnecessary. Like, it's not as if we're trying to make a big deal out of something that isn't a big deal. It right. is a big deal. There's enough proof that it's a big deal. You just don't need to be like, the sky is falling and the doom, you know.
And even that, I'm going to correct you, because you just said there's enough proof. And that's a word that's pulled out on both sort of sides of this conversation. And my response to that is, in science, we don't have proof. We have evidence. Proofs are for mathematics, right? Like, that's the, we have evidence, and either we have good evidence or we have weak evidence, bad evidence or no evidence. And no evidence, like, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, is the sort of common phrasing, which is to say that just because we don't have data doesn't mean that the lack of data automatically means that the thing is safe. So absence of evidence does not mean evidence of absence, meaning there's no evidence of harm.
That so, should be a t-shirt. With like,
yeah, I mean, it's, I didn't come up with this. Yeah. This is a very common saying. No, but
that's a good differentiation. And the evidence is overwhelming in a lot of these areas. Like, it's enough.
There's decades of research. And so oftentimes on sort of the opposing side of this conversation, where you have people that are very dismissive of environmental health issues being a big deal, and they are like complaining that everybody's overstating and all of this stuff, is that, you know, we don't have absolute proof, right? And we're never going to get absolute proof. We have an imperfect system. We don't test chemicals on people for ethical reasons. Historically, there have been incidences where we have. Those are tragic. We should not have done that. I can thumbtack that, because there's a couple really cool exceptions to that that are good. But in general, we don't test chemicals on people. So we don't have direct evidence in that manner. What we do test chemicals on are animals, rodent studies, mice, rats, and then upwards, you know, fish, amphibians, worms, flies. Like, we will use animal models to identify an effect, to hopefully identify a mechanism of action, meaning what physically is happening in the body, what cellular pathways are being activated, like what is happening. And then we look at human epidemiological data, which are population-wide studies, and we are looking for parallels in those trends. We're seeing, do we know in animals that this level of these chemicals causes this effect. We can measure chemicals in human populations. We've been doing that for decades through human biomonitoring studies. They're happening all over the world. And then we can analyze the data of those populations and say, do these populations have higher risk factors for XYZ? And in many cases, that research is really solid. Some places it's fuzzy. And that's why science is the evolution, right? We're constant. That's why researchers are always like, we need more research. We need to validate this. We need more studies. There's just a lot of people on sort of the opposing side of the conversation that are demanding proof. They say, prove it. Show me the studies that prove it. And I have to explain to them patiently, I try, that, like, again, in science, we don't have proof like that. We have evidence, and either the evidence is weak and we need more of it, or the evidence shows no association whatsoever. And so we can say, okay, yeah, there doesn't seem, the evidence is really good that this exposure is not harmful. And then we have this enormous, now decades old, massive hundreds of thousands of studies, library, essentially, of really good research that shows substantial evidence supporting the hypothesis that these chemicals are, in fact, contributing to chronic disease. The word cause is a very, you have to use that word very carefully, because a lot of times we don't have causal levels of association. We just have associations. Like, we don't know if this is causing it. It might be contributing to it. It's a chicken or egg situation. So I think that the people who sometimes are dismissive of the topic of environmental health set the bar of evidence at a place that's realistically, we don't hold other evidence. We don't hold other topics to that same bar. So when we're proving something is safe, we don't hold it to the same bar, right? Oh, there's evidence if it's safe. They don't prove that it's safe. It's just a whole...
Well, I knew a guy who ate that and he didn't die, so it's totally fine.
Well, there's that, yes. And there's anecdotal evidence, yeah. Right? That's the, like, lowest tier of evidence. Yeah. And then there's also to that, to kind of piggyback on the, like, well, I did it and I was fine. I've used these laundry detergents my whole life. My parents used them and their grandparents were fine. And that's a perspective topic, a perspective issue, because I would push back on that and say, but are you as an individual might be fine, but collectively, are we fine? Are we fine? No. We have staggering rates of chronic illness. We have increasing rates of cancers, of neurodegenerative problems, of behavioral problems.
Skin, mental health.
Yeah, skin issues, mental health issues. Like, no, collectively, we are not fine. And there's no... This is, again, the sort of simplistic mindset of people wanting a single cause or a single thing to point the finger at. And that's never the case. Like I said earlier, nothing is black or white. We live in this soupy gray area, and we're all exposed to varying degrees to environmental chemicals. And you know, researchers and people in the medical field that are tracking disease statistics are recognizing that for some types of conditions, the rates are increasing faster than can be explained by genetics. This is not a genetic component that we're just passing this down. There's an environmental factor. And from this lens, environmental means not just toxic exposures, but your lifestyle. Do you smoke? Do you exercise? Do you drink? You know, do you drink? What kind of trauma have you had in your life? Because all these factors can contribute. So the environmental toxicity piece certainly is just one piece, and it's a piece that every single person on the planet is touched by to some extent. And that we have decades of research showing is not great. So this is why I get, I think I'll be having this conversation until I die, right? Like, no,
yeah, but it's a necessary conversation. And I think even people who are trying to do what we would consider good in the world in regards to this topic need to understand these things as well.
Yeah.
like, I'm, if there's sides here, I'm definitely on your side, and I used incorrect terminology in asking you a question. So, like, it's important for people to understand this. And I want to shift gears a little bit and mention also one other way that I think people might kind of be, I don't know the right expression here, but with good intention, is what I did when I started finding these things out, is I became scared of everything, and threw out tons of stuff and spent tons of money to buy all kinds of new things, and then hyper analyzed every single decision I was making, and then immediately started criticizing everyone around me if they were not making the same decisions.
Right.
And was like, did you know that that, and my friends were like, dude, I don't care. I smoke. Yeah. Like, what do you, like, I don't care. Do you know what's in my cigarettes? Like, and I'm like, but the chemical, do you know what makes that drink red? Oh my God. Like, so, can you speak a little bit to the like rocket taking off with this information and what, how you would recommend, like, you primarily educate practitioners and coaches to teach their clients and patients, but I know that you do it in a way that's not quite like, you don't encourage them to tell their people to do what I did.
I mean, because it's overwhelming. I mean, even without doing anything, learning about this stuff is overwhelming. Right. And then, you know, people looking back on like, oh, if I wish I hadn't done that when I was pregnant, because now, right, there's all this like past reflection judgment that's like not constructive. It's not helpful. And so I really, you know, I kind of come at this from a couple different perspectives. One being that for the most part, this is such an important sort of thing to help contextualize this topic, is for the most part, when we're talking about sort of ambient background, everyday environmental exposures, I'm not talking about occupational exposures. Those are much higher. Those can be different. But for everyday background, sort of ambient exposures, there's no one single drinking out of a plastic bottle or sitting next to somebody who's got perfume on that's going to be the thing that causes or contributes to a health condition. It's not one thing. It is the totality of these exposures chronically every day over a lifetime that is, or during critical windows, say, for example, during conception, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are, that is what we're looking at. We're looking at this totality. And so what that coming from that perspective can help temper some of the anxiety that people have. So it gives them a little bit of grace to say, okay, like I forgot my water bottle, my stainless steel bottle at home. I'm at the airport. I got to fly. I'm just going to buy a bottle of water. And I'm also not going to stress about it, because certainly we know, you know, stress is extremely toxic to the body. Stress contributes to 80% of chronic disease. So we don't want to add stress on top of this. So I think if people come from this understanding that like it is, it's a long game. We're playing a very long game here. We're trying to work to systematically lower our exposures to as many of these environmental toxicants as we can without driving ourselves crazy or overburdening ourselves or being stressed out about everything. And when we can look at it through that lens, my experience in working with the thousands of health professionals that I have and them communicating with their clients about this is that this kind of lowers the, like, it ratchets down the anxiety, which we want to do, because it does not constructive for people to panic and look at their, you know, their bathroom and go, oh my God, I have to get rid of everything in the kitchen sink and all the chemicals. Oh, no, you can use your product up when you've used it up. So long as it's not giving you any kind of adverse immediate reaction, like a headache or, you know, migraines or anything, use it up. And when it's time to replace it, you replace it with something better, safer, cleaner ingredients. So like, that's one perspective that I think is important to communicate, both from me to your audience, and certainly for my students, to the clients or patients or social media followings or whatever that they have, is it's not what we do once in a while that matters. It's what we do every day that matters over time. So that's sort of one part. The challenge here is that those folks that are sharing these big sensational messages that are positioning or cataloging all of these exposures equally, and that they're all like a four alarm fire, that feeds into the problem that I'm trying to undo by saying, let's temper this conversation. Not everything is a four alarm fire. So I teach with my students that there's like this triage concept of like, yeah, the chemicals in your tap water are not great, but like you'll get there when it comes to filtering it. Yeah, there's toxic chemicals in a conventional mattress, but like asking a client to first, right out of the gate, throw out their mattress and buy a $3,000, $4,000 organic mattress is not the way, right? It's just too overwhelming. So I think that like tempering overwhelm is such an important skill around this conversation, and contextualizing. Like one of my favorite things in the world to do is to contextualize. I've probably done it a handful of times in this conversation. I don't even know I do it anymore, but like backing up and framing the conversation and then getting into the meat of it.
That's very rational, and rationality doesn't always win out in these conversations. No. So like often it doesn't, because it doesn't sell either. We're on the social media world where everybody has to like grab for attention. So putting out a post that's like, everyone's going to die because of this one thing is different than like a rational discussion around water chemicals. Yeah. So it's like, and how do you get the attention where it needs to be in the way that it needs to be it? And like something else I think in regards to like the all at once or all or nothing kind of approach is like, I didn't have any money when I was doing that.
Yeah.
So I was like literally going into debt.
I'm a mason jar girly. Like I didn't buy fancy glass. Like I just bought like a case of quart mason jars for like $12, and this was $15, and then this is what I use for storing my leftovers, or I reused, you know, the glass pasta sauce jar or the pickle jar, and reused those. Reusing plastic? No, reusing glass containers, that's fine.
Yeah, forever.
Yeah,
and they don't even turn red with the sauce like indeed, plastic ones don't. Do. But I literally went into debt to buy stuff all at one time that I couldn't afford. Right. And then that drove my nervous system over the edge and freaked me out. And I was panicked all the time and stressed about money. Now, it wasn't only that, like at the time, but that was contributing. It was and I would see the price of something and then be like, but I have to do this.
Right.
I have to do this. Like, I know that the thing I have is bad. So I have to do this. There's no choice. So I felt like I had no choice and I had to make all these too expensive decisions.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for me for then.
Yeah. Like, I mean, a lot of people have gone through that. And I also want to just point out that like the onus, although we as individuals are the ones that at the end of the day are having to go the extra mile, learn about ingredients and learn about materials and chemical migration so that we can make the better choice for ourselves. Because, you know, when you go to the store, you just have the illusion of choice. You don't really have, if you want to choose something that's not going to contribute to your toxic burden, very limited choices, right? Just at the retail level. Yeah,
we're not the ones dumping barrels of poison in the river.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is it's like the plastic straw analogy with like, you know, plastic pollution is, oh, well, if consumers just stopped using plastic straws, it would solve the problem. No, the onus should not be on us as individuals. The burden should not be on our shoulders to have to make these decisions, because those safer options should be available at retail level. We shouldn't even have to know about what a bisphenol is or what a phthalate is, right? That's absurd. But it's come to that.
Yeah, it should just be like, oh, that's poison. We don't sell that anymore. So now you have to make that out of something else.
Yeah.
And here's the other ones. Like here, they haven't had... So I moved to Italy 2.5 years ago. When I got here, there's no plastic, single-use plastic bags. Like, they don't exist. Yeah. Like, if you go somewhere, like, there's no plastic... They have what looks like plastic bags, but they're compostable bags. Yeah. Now, there are very few exclusions to this. Certain things have been grandfathered. I still come across them every once in a while.
Yeah.
And when I do, it's like so offensive to my system. I'm just like, wow, this is an actual plastic bag. How shitty. Yeah. I like forgot that they even exist. And then when I go back and visit in the States, even when I'm in like Northern California, like my wife's family lives in the Bay Area in California, which is one of, if not the most progressive places in the country regarding laws around environmental stuff.
Yeah. Plastic.
No, everywhere. All the bags. Yeah. All of them are plastic and styrofoam. I've never even seen styrofoam like here. Yeah. So, and it's like, what? But, and then they'll say, oh, well, you can't. These are too expensive. And I'm like, I don't think so, because this country has more money than that one. And the countries that have less money are using them. So, like, the alternatives are there. And I love that you say, like, and you don't make that decision. Like, you don't, Lara does not decide, can there be plastic bags in the state of New Mexico?
Right. And so this is where I think it's really important to be active in your community, to get to know your representatives, to find out where they stand on topics related to environmental chemicals, to be a squeaky wheel, to call companies, individual companies, and say, hey, does this product contain these ingredients? I really wish it wouldn't. Even if it doesn't change anything in the short term, we have to use our voice. And we have, as consumers, at the end of the day, we're the ones buying the stuff. And so we have ultimate control over the marketplace if we exercise the power that we have as consumers. And so, you know, we've seen the push for cleaner ingredients, better ingredients, more product transparency. We've already seen in the short time that I've been doing this work, the marketplace change. You have Target, Walmart, Costco, Walgreens, CVS, all these big box stores have policies against certain chemicals in their products. They, you know, Costco is the largest seller of organic foods in the United States. Target sells a lot of like quote unquote clean beauty. I'm putting that in air quotes because it's not a regulated term, whatever. And so what that's doing is it's making better products just available at the retail level. And so just the average consumer that's going into a Target or that's going into a Costco or that's going into a Walmart or whatever might pick up a better product off the shelf without even realizing it's better and then reap the benefit of not having that exposure. And so we have to be involved. Later at the end of the day, tomorrow, I have to write a 5-minute statement that I'm giving in the state of New Mexico about their plan to use hydrofracking wastewater in agriculture, which is just like an absolutely asinine, absurd thing. And I submitted a petition and was invited to give a statement. And I'm like, yes, absolutely, because we need people being loud about it, because it shouldn't be on our shoulders. We need regulations to change. We need policy to change. You know, people sometimes, you know, I'm very active, as you know, on my Instagram. I post about political topics and people are often like, stick to toxins, you know, stop talking about politics.
You are a saint with your responses on Instagram.
Not always. Not in my DMs, I'll say that. But anyway, this is a political topic.
Yeah.
This is absolutely linked irrevocably to politics, because how are chemicals regulated? Through regulation from government agencies.
Yeah.
It's just absurd.
The disconnect there between, like, I'm not going to say anything that's going to, we don't have enough time.
Yeah.
But the disconnect there is astonishing sometimes. Yes. And one of the first questions I got asked a lot, once I could understand the words being spoken to me here, was why do you put those things in your food? Like, and they were talking about, they often talk about like the colors and the food colorings and the dyes and then those kind of things, especially for kids' foods. Like, there's certain colors of food that isn't here. Like, you can't get blue, like blue food or purple food or what, like, it just isn't. And so they're like, why do you allow that? And I'm like, well, one, I don't
make the
rules. That's not my call. And they were like, well, if they try to sell that here, like, Italy just banned lab grown meat.
Yes.
And they've banned some other things. And some of them are really well guided. Some of them are a little misguided. But anyways, the people would be pissed. They're like, everyone here would just be pissed, and whoever allowed it to happen would be in trouble. Like,
and I have a theory as to why that is, because it's not just Italy. I mean, it's so. First of all,
well, I'm just using it as an example. Yes, it's the only other country I've lived in, and the difference is astonishing. The ho humness of the U.S. and then people being like, "Don't put poison blue shit in my food," is a very different.
It's cultural, right? Because I look at, I'm somebody who has, my brain works in this capacity where I can zoom really tight into the granular details, but I'm always zooming out. So I'm zooming out and zooming in. And so when this topic comes up, I zoom out and look at, like, okay, the span of human history, and from a, you know, duration of human existence, you know, Europe, Asia, Africa are much older places worth
that have food cultures, and
then the United States is kind of like this, you know, snotty brat young country, really, in the grand scheme of things. And so, you know, you have these deeply rooted cultural anchors that are rooted in food. I mean, look at the French with their wine. There was a French researcher who was, you know, he's been the thorn in the side of Monsanto about their, you know, glyphosate herbicide for many, many years. And he partnered up with chefs in France, and he did a blind taste test of French wines and wines that had were organic and non-organic. And these were, you know, people that have hyper palates, right? You're a chef. That's why they're chefs, is they've got these hyper palates. And they were able to, after a little bit of like training and comparison, they're like, oh, we can taste these chemicals. We can taste these herbicides. That's ruining our food.
So that's not okay.
Not okay. So it's like this really brilliant strategy to tap into this core cultural anchor, which is food. And we don't have that really here in the United States. Yes, there are communities within the United States. There's certainly indigenous communities here that have
But the U.S. as a whole doesn't have that type of food culture, you know, or its own history and cuisine. And that almost essential snobbiness. Because I couldn't even mention French wine around here.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, but the snobby, but that like what Americans would like what I used to consider snobby about food, like especially with the French or the Italians or the Spanish, it is protective in a way, and it is the reason people travel to come to these places to eat food and drink wine is because they're so aggressively protective over their food and their wine. So I think that's a great point. I never really spent a lot of time trying to figure out why it is. I just noticed the difference of the immediate outrage versus
my brain is always asking, so, like, why?
I want to ask you, before we go, a few steps people could take or actions that are big needle movers. And I think you've already given one, is being more engaged, like being more involved, like knowing what's going on, knowing when there's a referendum in your town voting on dumping some kind of crap in the water, or knowing when they're going to put poison water on the crops on purpose, and that there's a petition going around, sign it, find out who's going to support that, who's not, support the person who's not going to support that. Like, you know, so I think we can count that as one action step right there, is just getting more engaged and involved. So what other, like, say two needle movers, if we told everybody, don't try to do everything at once, don't get super overwhelmed, and don't be afraid of everything. So let's give them just a couple steps that you would say start here.
Yeah, I mean, I always want to encourage people to start with the things that are both free and easy. Again, the $3,000 new organic mattress isn't where we start, right? So we start with the things that are free. That also makes them accessible to everybody, because there's a massive disparity in access. The populations, certainly globally, but definitely here in the United States, that have disproportionately high exposures. These are Black and brown communities, low-income communities. They often have the least access to these safer solutions, which is another problem in the wellness space, where everybody's hawking like these multi-thousand dollar solutions. And I'm like, come on, man, health is for everyone. It's not just for people that are affluent. So the free and easy things, the first thing that I would recommend, this full stop, is just to get rid of home fragrances. So the scented candles, the air fresheners, the fabric sprays.
Febreze,
the plugins, the reed diffusers that seem like they're more natural. and just get rid of those. Like, stop buying them. Those will, that will save you money, right? Like, you're just stop buying them and literally throw out the ones that you have. So that we actually have research that shows that even scented candles are still emitting toxic chemicals into our air, even if they're not being burned, like just an unburned candle. And that's because if you can smell it, which you can, those chemicals are volatilizing out and they are being released. And when you're smelling them, they're going into your body. Inhalation is the fastest way to get something into your bloodstream outside of injection. So your air quality really matters. Indoor air quality is really bad for most people. And so it can be worse than air quality outside. So one.
Okay, ditch the scented stuff.
Yeah, just get rid of it.
Get involved and engaged. And what else you got?
Open your windows. Let the chemicals that are off-gassing from the things that you can't afford to replace, like your couch and your carpets and your furniture and your paint on your walls, let that escape. So air exchange is really important. Take off your shoes when you get to the front door. And then the last two more that are like free and easy is decline cash register receipts. Cash register receipts are coated with bisphenol powders. For the most part, there's a slow movement away, and we can absorb those through our fingers. And then just minimize single-use plastics, I think, is a really big one. I'm not going to say never use single-use plastic. That is not realistic. So minimize, reduce your exposure to those. Get a glass bottle, a stainless steel bottle, carry it with you, wash it. And those would be a really good baseline. If everybody just did those things, I think even just the fragrance, getting rid of the fragrance, would be such a massive needle mover for people.
Great. Thank you so much. And those are all easy things to do, and none of them cost money. So
yeah.
I don't want people to think that I'm just looking for reasons to bash America when it comes to toxins. I want to point out that they love receipts here. They will hand you multiple receipts for each purchase, not just one, more than one. And part of that is by law, because there's so many laws here that are designed to go against, like, under the table things and yeah. organized crime and whatever, that like every single purchase and every single expense and every single everything has to have tons of documentation.
Yeah.
If you don't take the receipt out of their hand, they will just put it on the counter right there in front of you. And it just stays there. Like, it's like an awkward kind of strange.
Yeah.
And they don't know about that. And where in the US, usually when you buy something, at least with a card on the little thing, you can push that you don't want it, or somebody will ask you if you want it. And it was so rare, even 2.5 years ago when I moved, it was so rare for me to walk out of a store and been handed one of those. They come out of those printers, those like smudgy paper. Here, I have like 12 of them just on my desk right now.
Yeah.
Like they're.
Yeah.
And so if that's not all sunshine and rainbows, folks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, you know, one, if it's ink. Mm-hmm. Then it's not a concern. If it's thermal paper.
No, so these are the nasties. Paper, yeah.
Okay. And you can tell it. If you leave it in the sun and it fades, that's thermal paper. It
turns purple.
Likely bisphenols. But that would be an example of like, okay, I'm going to navigate the world the best that I can. I'm going to do the best job I can. The goal is not zero exposure. The goal is less.
Yeah. As little as you can touch them.
And if that's a harder to navigate challenge where you live, then like pick something else to champion instead of that one.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to level my biases a little bit and let them know that it's not, everything isn't perfect in other places. It's just different which things kind of slip through the cracks culture to culture. So,
sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, where's the best place if there's any coaches or doctors or nutritionists or practitioners out there listening to this? Lara has incredible educational programs for you, and those are at laraadler.com. We'll have links and such down below. Where would they like get started, or what would you recommend they do if they're interested? Is it reach out to you? Is there something for them to try out?
People can just reach out to me. The Talking Toxins course that I have is sort of like the flagship foundation course. Start there. But for everybody else, you can also just like follow me on my Instagram, which is at Environmental Toxins Nerd, and just kind of get a feel for the type of information and how I share it. And, you know, I say to practitioners, and the Instagram is obviously for anybody, so you don't have to be a practitioner. I have many.
Her Instagram's great, by the way. Yeah. It's really, really good content.
But I have a lot of health practitioners that are like, oh, your content is so great, I send my clients to your account. And my goal is for them to be educated so that they can have the deeper dialogue about lifestyle and behavior change as it pertains to toxic exposures that I can't have because my business doesn't serve the average person. And so I want them to not send their contacts to me, but to then just become educated themselves so that they then can work with their clients or patients directly on those topics, which I think is just so important.
It is. And you're raising the literacy. You've worked with, thousands of practitioners.
About five-ish thousand
practitioners, yeah. Know a lot more about this subject from a whole bunch of countries. And thank you for kind of shifting the conversation in the industry, which does trickle down to everybody who's working with these practitioners or watching their Instagrams or social medias or anything like that. And then we also do have something at Rebel Health that we did with you. That's a workshop series that is an offer for laypersons. If you want to get a little toe in the water and go deeper into this subject, it's really great. We'll put a link to it. It's called Detoxify Your Life. It's a workshop series we did with Laura, and it walks you through different areas of your home and your life and how to make the most informed choices. So we'll put all the links to all the things down below the show. And thank you so much for being the nerd that's looking out for all the rest of us.
I'm trying.
All right. Thank you.